Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program.
Spanning hundreds of square miles, the Iroquois Confederacy dominated the American frontier in the 18th century. A unified collection of six nations, their attempts at trade monopolization and aggressive expansion altered the fates of two European empires and brought a fragile balance to a continent divided and defined by war. A testament to power and politics, this native group was a critical player in the war to determine the fate of North America. On this episode, we discuss the Iroquois Confederacy. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the colonial frontiers of North America, the people and ideas that shaped it, and the events and places that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything Wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we're discussing the Iroquois Confederacy and getting a better glimpse and a deeper view into the Indian world that existed at the dawn of the 17th and 18th centuries in North America. It's a confusing world, and it's often very perplexing, and the result, as we'll see, tends to be disregarding or minimizing the impact of the Indian world in events that are viewed as largely European affairs. We truly cannot begin to understand the Indian world without understanding the pre-existing Indian superpower of the time period. That, of course, will be the Iroquois Confederacy. But what made the Iroquois so unique? And what made them so powerful in the 17th and 18th century worlds? Well, that will be the crux of our discussion today. Now, this will involve some history, this will involve a great deal of backstory, and it will also involve the occasional offshoot into another discussion of why and how the Indian world operates the way that it does. I think we should begin, though, by discussing why we as historians for so long have often disregarded or minimized Indian participation in the larger history of the New World. A lot of it comes from the fact that what we see and what we're studying seems very alien to us. It seems very foreign to us. And in many cases, it is. We often can, in a lot of ways, try and mold or bend or form the Indian world into something that we, as products of the Western world, are more comfortable with. This is not unique. People of the same time period did the same thing. Europeans trying to understand a foreign culture. But we must establish that first. This is a foreign culture. The Indian world, until 1492, developed completely on its own, absent from any Western traditions. They had their own unique American traditions, and we do see similarities in the great Mesoamerican cultures, like the Aztec, or the Maya, or the Olmec, or the Inca. But these are not offshoots of some distant Roman world. So it can be very confusing for us. That leads to not only different value systems, but different perceptions of the world altogether. What a difficult set of circumstances. But that's why, as historians, we work the way we do. Because we've only began in the last 30 or 40 years to really understand how different this world really is. Today's discussion will be essential to unraveling the mystery of the melting pot that is colonial North America. Because the Indian peoples, regardless of their creed and regardless of their political affiliation, will be an integral part of that story. So who are these people? Understanding the Indian world, particularly from the Iroquois vantage point, it's going to be essential that we first deal with the geography of the story, because it will play so much into the conflicts that we're about to see. The ancestral homeland of the Iroquois is what is today what we think of as New York State, specifically ranging from as far west as the Great Lakes to as far east as modern-day Albany. This would be our modern understanding of upstate New York, but the real heart of the Iroquois world will effectively follow what is today in New York, I-90, going through the Finger Lakes region, Syracuse, all the way to Buffalo. Now, when we consider European arrival in the 16th and 17th centuries, we know how this story plays out. The French congregated entirely around the St. Lawrence River Valley, and that would interject them in many cases directly into a pre-existing Indian world that they were not equipped to deal with. You could also say that the Indian world was not equipped to deal with them. So where do the Iroquois Confederacy come from? Well, let's start from the beginning. Consider that swath of land I just described to you, stretching from western New York to eastern New York. And consider as a very tight, confined place, you would have a large amount of competition for resources, viable hunting grounds, access to water, you name it. These are the reasons that everyone goes to war all the time. And the collective nations that will become the Iroquois Confederacy were no different. They were equally susceptible to these issues. Now, going from west to east, these warring tribes consisted of the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Onondaga, the Oneida, and the Mohawk. And while for most of their political futures they would be aligned, early on, they're in combat a great deal. And it's, again, a battle for resources. Now, here is where the difficulty of working in Native American history really emerges. The difficulty is that in almost every case, there is no written linguistic component to the Indian world. Many of the tribes we'd see in the Iroquois world spoke over a dozen languages. They are not unintelligent people in that way. But a written linguistic component tends to be a Eurasian side effect. It's something really only seen in the Western world and beyond. The Atlantic Ocean is enormous. That Western tradition never transferred over to North America. Again, we'll stress, they had their own unique American way of life. And the issue we have with that is that we lose much of our interpretation of history before Europeans arrive in the New World. Now, we do have rich oral traditions from within the native communities themselves, but as historians, we always have to consider them in a class of their own, because over time, events we can say are lost in translation. We do not often question these sources. That's important for us to clarify. Because it's an oral tradition, that does not make it ineffectual or inaccurate. What it does make very difficult for us, though, is accurate dating of the events. Because based on our common era, the year zero, the birth of Christ, that we use in the Western world, that doesn't necessarily sync up with the interpretation of time in the Indian world. So these are some of the problems we face, but by our best analysis of the native history of North America, we begin to see those five warring tribes we've already talked about aligning themselves politically sometime after the year 1200 and before the year 1450. Some will go even a century before that, but that's a debatable point, and there's no way to ever clarify that. Again, history asks the questions where we don't see a yes or no answer, where there is no proverbial smoking gun. And this is one of the bits of information we're going to have to deal with. We just have to set it aside and accept that it is what it is. But the Iroquois world will form together. These five tribes will come together in mutual alliance, as legend has it, under the command of two different native chieftains. They are Dekondawida and Hiawatha. These two men are considered to be prophets in the Iroquois world. And they are able to produce a message not only of peace, but they're known for emphasizing the prosperity that peace can bring. They form together the Iroquois Confederacy, and with it, something we could recognize as a modern form of government. At least a form of government that'll be effective in a world that'll be very quickly invaded and altered by European explorers and financiers. So it's an interesting idea, but these two prophets, Dekondawida, known as the Great Peacemaker, and Hiawatha, bring forward a new age of peace and prosperity amongst five tribes traditionally that never got along all that well. Now, when these forces come together, they will be led by 50 hereditary chieftains. It'll be a standard of government. And they will meet near what is today Syracuse, New York, the land of the Onondaga. The supreme chief, if that's something we feel comfortable saying, is known as the Tododaho. And the Tododaho gets his name from what many consider in the oral tradition to be the last chief to really join the Confederacy, giving up his power and taking his seat among his peers as equals. So the Tododaho is still known as a position of great esteem, if not higher esteem, amongst these 50 hereditary chieftains in the Iroquois world. But whenever they came together, whenever they began to experience the mutual benefit of a political alliance, what they would call the Iroquois League of Peace, we begin to see almost unchecked prosperity develop in the Iroquois world, making the Iroquois the supreme Indian superpower of the American Northeast. And as far as colonial American history is concerned, that makes them arguably the most powerful Indian force in all of the continent. So, a little bit about that, the formation of the Iroquois League, politically the Iroquois Confederacy. Let's get into the Iroquois mindset a bit. For the Iroquois, this League of Peace was central to everything. And like all cultures, they develop very quickly their own symbolic sense of governance and perceptions in the world. We see this in all societies everywhere, but let's begin to tear apart the Iroquois worldview a bit. They considered themselves ceremonially and symbolically the people of the longhouse. That is the Haudenosaunee in Iroquoian. They visualized their political superstructure as the basic unit of family and home that they based their life around every day. They called themselves the people of the longhouse because physically they resided in the traditional Iroquois longhouse, but also it gave a sense of community and a sense of political unity to a group of five different tribes that didn't have that shared history already. And everyone, as far as the tribes are concerned, played a different role in the way that the politics were decided and the policy was administered in the ceremonial or proverbial longhouse. So let's talk a bit about that. The Seneca peoples, as the westernmost members of this group, were known as the keepers of the western door. On the extreme opposite end of Iroquois, the Mohawk were considered the keepers of the eastern door. The Cayuga were considered to be the ceremonial younger brothers of the Seneca, and the Oneida, the ceremonial younger brothers of the Mohawk. In the center, the fifth nation, the nation considered to be the heart of the Iroquois world, as far as the Great Council Fire is concerned, were the Onondaga. They were known as the Keepers of the Fire. And it's in Onondaga territory, near today what is Syracuse, New York, that these five tribes would send representatives in council, and they would meet to make decisions for the good of the Confederacy. Remember, a Confederacy is not a republic. A Confederacy has an explicit contract that states these five entities will work together when it suits them, but reserve the right to separate at any time. So whenever you hear a term Confederacy, it has a very specific meaning. But with this system, the Iroquois will become supreme and dominant for a number of reasons. And politically, when Europeans arrive, they become very early on a very potent force to be dealt with. So, where do the stresses come from? The Iroquois have formed together, but why is it so essential at this time? Well, we aren't certain of this, but many historians are beginning to take the view that the Iroquois are imperialists. Now, typically, empire is a very difficult thing to see on paper, but it's undeniable when you see it. No one will often write, "We are the blank empire." But you know empire when you see it. At least I do, and I hope you will as well. But the Iroquois become very expansionist. And unlike other empires of the New World, they aren't necessarily in it for the same reasons. Now, they're trying to accomplish the same goals, but the way they're going to accomplish that is going to be very different. When the French begin trading along the St. Lawrence River, they begin to find that other existing Indian peoples are benefiting from the trade different than they are. And early on, this causes a great amount of stress and a great amount of competition. We begin to see the Iroquois making clear efforts with dramatic policy shifts to eliminate competition from the northern shore of the St. Lawrence River Valley and the northern shores of the Great Lakes. And we see warfare become an absolute way of life during the time period. Now, here's where it gets to be very misleading. In the European world, our virtues and our values, the Western world, if you would, place emphasis on material wealth. We view the most successful people, in most cases, as a whole, with having the most money and having the most stuff. Cars, airplanes, large houses, you name it. We are a material-based culture, but the native world, the Indian world, is no such thing. Again, remember, it develops from an entirely different tradition. They are what we would think of as a warrior culture. They value the man who fights the greatest. They value the man who fights the hardest. You are not just given rank of something like a general in the Indian world, but you very much earn it. So again, they are a warrior culture. They're used to fighting when competing politically. It's a difficult world for us to understand because it's a very different tradition. Now, if you study the colonial American world, you will inevitably run into a historian named Fred Anderson. He's wrote some of the most influential books on the time period. And Fred Anderson gives us what he calls a war and trade hypothesis. And it goes something like this. In the Western world, we view the natural standard of existence as war and peace. That is, when you're not fighting, you're in a stage between fighting or a stage with no fighting. But that isn't necessarily reflected in the Indian world. He will say the natural state of things from the native perspective is not war and peace, but war and trade. Think of that. Trade is everything to these people. From the Indian world, if you're trading with a group of other peoples, then things are naturally at peace. Trade is the natural order. If you're not trading, then you're at war, and fighting is inevitable. So again, it's a difference in perspective. From the Western viewpoint, from the viewpoint of the early settlers to the region, they view an absence of combat as a time of success. From the native world, though, for them, a time of success is a robust and thriving commercial culture, a trade-based culture. So it's no surprise, then, that when a rich and lucrative trade opportunity, like that of the French Empire, arrives in the New World, the native peoples will instantly turn to combat to win the license, so to speak, to trade with those European peoples. Because the Iroquois are well-aligned, because they're well-adjusted, because they're operating on one policy, putting all of their resources together, they will be wildly successful in this regard. Now, interesting point. I mentioned earlier that the Iroquois peoples called themselves the Haudenosaunee, the people of the Longhouse. But where does the term Iroquois come from? Well, we aren't sure of this, but we promise the word Iroquois is not an Iroquois word. It's very likely that the French began calling the Iroquois peoples Iroquois, based on a word that a rival tribe of people used to describe them, and it was a derogatory term. They called them the real adders, or the real snakes, and that's a name the French picked up, and that's a name that's been picked up throughout the history books as well. So we have here a rich cultural tradition, but the name we use to describe them is very much a slight to their very organized and very well-constructed and effective culture. But this basis of trade, this interjection of European affairs, will be everything for us. And we can't understand how and why the Iroquois become so powerful if we don't understand that. Now, we're going to talk about a series of events in this podcast that will be viewed through the eyes of a European. Remember, the native peoples do not have a written component to their language. So much of what we understand of the Indian world is told through their eyes. My most recent book features the life of a prominent Seneca chieftain named Gaius Suta, and it was an incredible experience for me, because all the while you're used to writing a traditional biography with journals and letters and accounts from multiple peoples on the same occasion, I had to reconstruct the life of Gaius Suta through the use of outside sources, European sources, who didn't understand what they were seeing and didn't understand what the actions of Gaius Suta represented. His life and his experiences are highly applicable in this study, and it was a very rewarding yet challenging project for me. So let's talk a little bit about how the Iroquois went about their business, because it's very indicative of the larger native world, and it's very different than what we're used to seeing. One of the things we'll see over and over again is a major divide in how politics are carried out in the New World, between European powers and native powers. In the European world, all deals are completed with the signing of a document. We know exactly what that means. You purchase a car, you use your credit card, you sign your name. And documents of that sort would be thrusted at native peoples throughout the history of colonial America. And it often led to some of the most confusing and wildly perplexing experiences that we'll encounter in the historical record. There's a major difference between the European view and the Indian view, and those documents are a great way to see it. For the Indian peoples, signing a name on a document meant very little to them initially, because it carried absolutely no standing in what they perceived to be a political agreement. Signing ink on paper represents nothing. Indian diplomacy, particularly in the 17th and 18th centuries, is a very physical form of diplomacy. It was not about scratching your name or your symbol on a piece of paper, but it was about a physical, tangible, real, visible display of agreement. So the native peoples would often signify agreements with the passing of a ceremonial or symbolic object, most often known as the wampum string. What is the wampum string? Well, the wampum string was a relatively large and ornate piece of material made up of small freshwater shells. These shells were colored either by nature or through dye and arranged in such a way to make a pattern. So you had multiple colors of the wampum belt, a string of wampum, often about 3 feet long, that would be passed from occasion to occasion. There would be a wampum signifying political alliance. There would be a wampum signifying war. But there was only one wampum string for each group of people. So whoever held that wampum string held the physical manifestation of their agreement. Picture that compared to, say, 1776, with the Continental Congress signing their names all very voraciously on the Declaration of Independence. You would never see something like that in the Indian world, but to those men, it represented a major agreement, an unbreakable bond. In the Indian world, it was that physical expression of alliance. It was a physical diplomacy, as I like to call it, that often signified to the day. Now, these wampum strings were never passed in secret, because witnesses physically being there was as important as the wampum string being there itself. Proceedings would often be formed in a council around a fire with multiple representatives from all groups, because a pact, a union, was being formed, an agreement was being solidified, and witnesses had to be present. There are many cases where European parties are fully prepared to make agreements, and the native parties are fully prepared to make agreements, but they won't do it because the wampum string is physically not in attendance. It's very frustrating for Europeans during this time, but it's an absolutely essential part of the Indian world that they had to recognize. Nothing would get done from their perspective if the wampum was not in place. And it's amazing how big this really gets. Some of the most compelling information I find is how Europeans deal with this system. After the 1750s, after 1763, the end of the Great French and Indian War, the British Empire is actually manufacturing wampum strings back in London and sending them to the New World, manufacturing them on an industrial scale, because they understood all agreements had to go through that physical expression of diplomacy, so they made them on a massive scale. And most of the wampums were handmade in the New World, and they were beautiful and they were exceptional. But the European perspective, we cannot stress enough, is just a very different one. So, we've talked a little bit about the order of Indian business, and we've also talked about the arrival of Europeans in the New World. Now we need to get into some of the details of how they change each other, because we have this view, particularly on the frontier, that we're seeing one group and one worldview clashing with another. And in some cases, at least initially, that's true. But what is an absolute certainty is the fact that frontier life often and always, as a matter of fact, breeds its own unique version of life, its own identity. The native peoples change the European peoples and vice versa equally and constantly throughout all of their interactions. So, how does this change first manifest itself? Well, when the French arrive in the St. Lawrence River Valley, they begin to look at who are their viable options of partnership. And this will be led by a man named Samuel de Champlain. And Champlain will choose the enemy of the Iroquois over the Iroquois themselves. To him, it's not an easy decision, but it makes itself readily apparent at the time. Now, Champlain certainly didn't know that that decision would make him an age-old enemy of the Iroquois, and it would make his French world an equally long-standing enemy as well. So early on in the European experience, the Iroquois and the French have a natural aversion to each other. And when the English will arrive, the Iroquois will look to them as an enemy of the French, in many ways as a natural ally. Now, the English would be nothing to the Iroquois if they were not trading, and the Iroquois begin to realize they can still benefit from the presence of New France along the St. Lawrence River Valley as well. The French have their own trading partners, the Huron and Algonquian-speaking peoples, and the Iroquois understand that if we can take them out, if we can eliminate them from the scene, we can monopolize all of this trade. And they'll begin to actually play these two European powers off of one another. I had a professor who was very dear to me, and he used to use the analogy that they played the English and French off of one another like children in a very contentious divorce. They'd go to the French to gain many goods, they'd go back to the English, relaying what the French gave them, hoping to get more. And it was an endless cycle. But it benefited the Iroquois very much. This became a pattern of conquest for the Iroquois. The idea that you could eliminate competition in the Indian world. And because these Europeans desired and really required trade on such a regular basis, you could become their primary trading partner. And by the time we get to the 1640s and the 1650s, 60s, and 70s, we see it lead to one of the most violent and brutal periods in the history of North America. Interestingly enough, that we know almost nothing about. It, of course, involves war. Now, war in the Indian world is viewed, like all aspects of life, entirely differently than war in the European world. But what we'll see is an Iroquois expansion, an aggressive expansion, into territories they did not previously control, but that would give them complete domain over European trade in the region. We call these the Beaver Wars. Now, why they're called Beaver Wars has a lot to do with the fact that the most desirable fur in North America at this time was the beaver pelt. It has a lot to do with the physiology of the beaver pelt itself, but beaver fur, because of the tiny barbs on the individual hairs, is excellent for making a very fine felt, which is perfect for making a fine top hat back in Europe. But at any rate, beginning in about the middle of the 17th century, the Iroquois will begin expanding aggressively into places they never influenced before. And that expansion would require fighting the existing populations, and if necessary, wiping them out entirely. The list of peoples who were not only defeated, but almost completely disappear during the Beaver Wars are a testament to just how brutal and how bloody this combat really was, and also gives us a fascinating insight into the larger Indian perceptions of warfare. Groups like the Anishinaabe in modern Canada, groups like the Huron tribe, the Petun tribe, the Neutral tribe, the Erie, and the Susquehannock, all were effectively eliminated by combat with the Iroquois peoples. Now, how were they eliminated? At first glance, this could be seen as, and was often viewed, as a major genocide in the history of North America, a genocide we'll never effectively have the numbers for. And because we were viewing Indian War from our own perceptions of war, our Western perceptions of war, that was the prevailing narrative of the Beaver Wars. But we know now that probably isn't the case. Because in the Indian world, everything was about, as far as war is concerned, family, strength, and in the end, balancing numbers, balancing the militant budget, so to speak. And here's what I mean. Whenever a people would be conquered, a native tribe, if possible, will try to replenish their own numbers by taking captives and adopting them into the tribes from within the people they conquer. It's a very strange idea to us, but because native populations tend to be so small and spread out over such a large area, active warriors tend to be sparse. So if a people are conquered, they're given the option of either being killed or becoming one of the tribe. The women would certainly be taken captive and married into the tribe, the children as well. If a warrior puts up a fight, he'd be killed. But otherwise, he'd be absorbed into the Iroquois nation itself. And really, that's true of all native peoples. But it is a, we can say, privilege of the victor in the Indian world. Many within the larger Iroquois community refer to the Beaver Wars as the mourning wars. That is, in mourning as in the loss of a loved one. Because so many people were killed, these individuals were absorbed into the tribe to replace those numbers. In that way, we can say, when it's all said and done, the Iroquois Confederacy tends to be one of the most ethnically diverse native groups in all of North America, because there was so much warfare in their world that they were constantly needing to draw new peoples into their communities. And these are not just fellow native peoples. These are not just their Algonquian neighbors, but this is true of Europeans as well. It is not uncommon in the 18th century to see many white women and white children of European descent living with and amongst the Indians very happily. Not all, but many of them were quite satisfied with their new life. It's a different version of the Indian world, so different from ours that we don't even have a word that accurately translates what it means. Captive, kidnap, hostage. These are all words we have, but they don't necessarily reflect the historical record in the most complete way. So remember, we're dealing with completely different traditions. At any rate, what we'll see at the end of the Beaver Wars is the Iroquois conquest being immense. They move into all of western Pennsylvania. They take all of what will become West Virginia, and even parts of the modern state of Virginia. They'll absorb the entire state of Ohio, what will become the eastern portion of Michigan, almost all of the state of Kentucky, all of the state of Indiana, and much of the state of Illinois. Effectively, they dominate the entire Ohio River Valley. Now, do they really control that? Well, again, their ancestral base is upstate New York. And the people that live there will be much more something akin to a subject of the Iroquois than Iroquois themselves. But this will be the result of these imperial conquests, and it will really take them into the early years of the 18th century or the 1700s. They have a unique distaste for the French, that's clear, and very quickly an alliance with the Empire of Great Britain, the ultimate enemy of the French, is formed. We call this the Covenant Chain. And the Covenant Chain will weaken over time, but it will also strengthen. And by the time we get to the 1740s and the 1750s, the time that will be the beginnings of the French and Indian War, that's the North American portion of the worldwide 7 Years' War, the Iroquois are firm British allies. So when you study the native world, you must be very careful not to view it, and this is true of all foreign cultures, from your worldview. Now, we all have biases. We can't ignore those. And we certainly, as historians, history lovers, and students of history, can't eliminate them. But we can begin to recognize them. And we can begin to see how they limit our understanding of whatever topic we're looking at. The Indian world has been terribly misunderstood for much of the last 200 years of history because we were unable to make that leap to view this world from a different viewpoint. So we relegated them. We made the battle for North America one like a game of chess, which put the French versus the British with the Indians as the pawns and the chessboard being North America. But when you take the view of Native peoples that we've really developed over the last 30 years, you see an entirely different story emerge. You see it much more like perhaps a game of poker, not pitting two forces against one another, but being a much larger and dramatic narrative, maybe with the Native peoples dealing the cards. It's almost hard to quantify, but to minimize them, particularly a force as powerful as the Iroquois Confederacy, one that would be mostly agreed to be the third empire of North America, along with the British and French, is not only doing a great disservice to them, but a great disservice to all of us as historians. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.